Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Representatives of Libya's rival factions who are in Tunis and negotiating through a UN-brokered process announced Tuesday that they formed a unity government aimed at stemming the chaos that has engulfed the country in recent years. In a statement received by the Associated Press, the Unity Presidential Council said it agreed on a 32-member cabinet drawn of representatives from across the country. But whether that government will be able to, in fact, govern the country remains to be seen. A jihadist attack on a top Burkina Faso hotel was carried out by six gunmen, three of whom are still on the run. That's according to the French Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, Tuesday. He said six individuals opened fire on the Cappuccino Cafe before taking refuge in a hotel. That's in Friday's attacks in the capital of Ouagadougou. Three were killed and three are still being sought, Valls speaking to Parliament. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has vowed that al-Shabaab will pay a heavy price for the attack Friday that reportedly killed dozens of Kenyan soldiers in southern Somalia. He spoke to the nation Tuesday, and Kenyatta said, "Kenya is unbowed. As I speak to you today, our defense forces are conducting an intense search, rescue, and recovery operation." Officials in northwestern Pakistan say a suspected suicide blast Tuesday killed at least 12 people and wounded many more. Witnesses say the bomber was riding a motorbike and struck a security checkpoint separating the Khyber tribal district from Peshawar. Rescue workers and local officials say a senior officer of the tribal police force and a local journalist are among the dead. So far, there are no immediate claims of responsibility. A majority of the victims are said to be security forces. VOA News. U.S. President Barack Obama welcomes Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull to the White House for a meeting Tuesday to discuss the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal and the fight against the Islamic State. Australia has been conducting airstrikes in both Iraq and Syria as part of the U.S.-led coalition bombing Islamic State targets since late 2014. The United States expressed deep concern Monday about the humanitarian situation in Syria, where the U.N. says 13.5 million people are in need of aid nationwide. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, called particular attention to 15 areas under siege, saying the Syrian government is responsible for 12 of the blockades and that at least 35 people have died there since the beginning of December. She called on all parties in Syria to allow unhindered access to humanitarian groups. The United Nations says in a new report that Iraq's war with Islamic State militants have led to more than 18,800 civilian deaths and more than 36,000 wounded between January 2014 and October 2015. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The report is based largely on testimony from victims, survivors, or witnesses of violations and says that during the period from May to October of last year, nearly 4,000 civilians were killed and more than 7,000 wounded. About half of these deaths took place in the capital, Baghdad. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani tells VOA, "The figures do not fully capture what is happening in Iraq.
These only include the people who were directly killed by violence. This does not include the countless others who have died from the lack of access to basic food, to water, and to medical care. And also bear in mind that the security situation in Iraq prevents us from doing a lot of our work."
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. Supreme Court announced Tuesday that it will hear a case challenging President Obama's plan to protect more than 4 million undocumented immigrants from deportation. The president's move was to defer deportation of parents of American-born children and permanent residents. The court's decision to hear the case could have an impact on the 2016 presidential election. The case is expected to be argued in April. A bright orange zinnia has blossomed aboard the International Space Station, marking a first in space. The first flower ever grown in space makes its debut, according to a Twitter photo by U.S. astronaut Scott Kelly. The crew on the ISS has already grown and eaten lettuce last year aboard the orbiting craft. They hope to produce tomatoes for next year. A scientist working on the project said the plants grown so far are not perfect, but it has helped researchers. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hayes Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Cameroon Christians have started guarding of mosques during prayer sessions, and Muslims are also guarding churches after five attacks on mosques by suspected Boko Haram fighters.
That's reporter Moki Edwin Kinzeka in Cameroon. Details coming up.
Also, Shiite Muslims in Nigeria say they will not participate in a state inquiry into a deadly clash with the Nigerian military last month. And the UN Refugee Agency reports tens of thousands of newly displaced people in Niger are in desperate need of international assistance.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Cameroon Christians have started guarding mosques during prayer sessions, and Muslims are also guarding churches after five attacks on mosques by suspected Boko Haram fighters. The fifth mosque was attacked by a teenage male suicide bomber near the nation's border with Nigeria yesterday. Boko Haram is now attacking not only churches, schools, and markets, but mosques, making Cameroonians more united to fight what they call a common enemy. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
This is a call to morning prayer in the central mosque at Mozogo, located on Cameroon's border with Nigeria. The faithful assemble while members of the local vigilante committee keep guard and make sure no stranger is given access. Among the vigilantes is 55-year-old Jacques Mabali, a Christian of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Cameroon. He says he responded to the call of his church's hierarchy to protect the Muslim faithful when they gather for their religious obligations.
C'est une action sociale et c'est très bien.
He says he is carrying out a social activity for the well-being of his country. He says it is his duty as a Christian to defend his country and aid suffering people and humanity, and adds that it is unfortunate Cameroon is suffering such violence. Ibrahim Mokhtar, a Muslim youth leader in Mozogu, says they too surround and secure churches because the insurgents have on several occasions attacked Christians.
En tant que fidèle, je fais la prière que Dieu nous protège dans cette histoire-là, et ça nous inquiète trop.
He says he is not only praying for God to save Cameroon from the killer group Boko Haram, but coming out to secure churches because Christians and Muslims are brothers and sisters. He says some of his family members are Christians and others like him are Muslims. He says they are not only praying ceaselessly, but working hard to end terrorism. The Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram has been active in Cameroon for 3 years, looting, killing, burning schools, markets and churches. The vigilante groups were created to assist the government after Boko Haram began using female suicide bombers early last year. In December 2015, suspected members of Boko Haram, which said it was attacking Cameroon to create an Islamist state, started attacking mosques. Governor Mijiyawa Bakari of Far North Cameroon has congratulated Christians and Muslims for working together to protect the country from the terrorist group and urged others in the country to follow the example.
Nous l'avons vu et nous avons applaudi à deux mains cette mesure qui a consisté pour...
He says he visited areas in Mayochanaga on Cameroon's border with Nigeria, where Muslims took guard of churches while Christians prayed and vice versa. He says that is one of the best things that is happening to assist Cameroon and Nigerian soldiers fighting the Boko Haram insurgency. He says it once more indicates how Cameroon is a land of legendary interreligious tolerance and that everybody seems to condemn the barbaric acts of Boko Haram. Cameroon believes the fighters have resorted to attacking mosques because their ability to strike has been drastically reduced following raids on Boko Haram strongholds by Cameroonian and Nigerian troops. Of Cameroon's 23.7 million people, 40% are Christians, 20% Muslims, and the rest hold indigenous beliefs. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The UN Refugee Agency reports tens of thousands of newly displaced people in Niger are in desperate need of international assistance. The UNHCR says about 1,000 people have fled in recent weeks from attacks launched by Nigerian Boko Haram insurgents. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says aid agencies are struggling to help the newly displaced who are living in makeshift shelters along the volatile Niger-Nigeria border. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards tells VOA, the people are a mix of internally displaced from Niger, some of whom have been forced to flee several times, and Nigerian refugees. He says they are scattered along one of the most difficult and remote areas in that part of West Africa.
People are spread out over a wide area. This is contributing to the difficulties in reaching them. There are no camps as such there. As I said, it's a spontaneous settlement environment. Security is certainly a problem, and this is something we are talking to the authorities about. So far, the military authorities haven't been able to provide protection across this wide area. That's something that has to be looked at.
Edwards describes the situation as very serious. He says there are acute shortages of adequate shelter and non-food items for the displaced. He adds there also is an acute shortage of money. He notes the UNHCR has received less than half of the $51 million it needs to run its Niger operation.
UNHCR is redirecting available resources to try and meet the needs that we're seeing there. We're calling on donors for extra help to support the vulnerable population. Local officials expect more people to flee the volatile border area when the dry season returns, which I understand is at the end of February typically, and when Nigerian military operations resume in the area.
Edwards says newly arrived families have few sanitation facilities and have to walk long distances to fetch water. He says the medical charity Doctors Without Borders is providing health care and sanitation, but it too is strapped for funds. He says many children are unable to attend school. For now, he notes, the World Food Program has enough supplies on hand to meet food demands. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A spokesman for a group of Shiite Muslims in Nigeria says they will not participate in a state inquiry into a deadly clash between the group and the Nigerian military last month. Chris Stein has more from Lagos.
The fighting between the Islamic Movement in Nigeria, or IMN, and the military left hundreds dead last month in the northern city of Zaria. The military says they were forced to take action against the Shiite Muslim sect after its members blocked a convoy carrying Army Chief General Tukur Baratai. Video released by the military shows protesters blocking the road while military officers try to negotiate with them. The military characterized it as an assassination attempt. The IMN denies this. They say their members were killed indiscriminately after the general had left the area. IMN spokesman Ibrahim Musa says more than 1,000 people were killed and 730 remain missing. He also says IMN leader Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zakzaki was shot several times and then arrested. The Kaduna state government says it has convened a commission of inquiry into the killings. But Musa says they will not participate until Zakzaki is released.
We want the immediate release of our leader simply because he is the one that is in the best position to explain and tender some other things the commission might or would like to know about the whole crisis.
Musa also accused Kaduna Governor Nasser al-Rufai, who appointed the commissioners, of being biased against the IMN.
We don't expect fairness and justice from this judicial commission.
A Kaduna state spokesman was not available to comment. Human Rights Watch has called the military's behavior in Zaria as unjustified. Nigeria researcher for the group, Mazi Sagun, says the IMN refusal to participate in the inquiry will undermine its authority.
The outcome of the investigation or the work of the commission would be jeopardized without the full involvement or cooperation of a major party to the clashes.
The National Assembly is also investigating the incident. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
A new humanitarian response plan has been announced for Somalia. Aid agencies are requesting $885 million this year. UN officials say nearly 5 million people are in need of food aid, while more than 1 million remain displaced within Somalia. They also say 308,000 children under age 5 are acutely malnourished, and they warn about 56,000 face death if not treated. The humanitarian response plan aims to reduce the number of people needing food assistance from 5 million to 3.2 million this year, and also to lower malnutrition prevalence rates.
Since the beginning of the year, more than 31,000 migrants and refugees have arrived in Greece by sea. The International Organization for Migration says that's compared to nearly 1,500 in all of January last year. About 48% of the arrivals in Greece this year are Syrians. The next largest group are Afghans, followed by Pakistanis. Those three groups have an easier time legally entering the European Union. Many other nationalities are being turned back. Meanwhile, winter weather has arrived in Europe, making travel and shelter more difficult for migrants and refugees. Temperatures are forecast to fall to minus 20 degrees Celsius along the border between Macedonia and Serbia. And snow has fallen on the Greek island of Lesbos, which is the main arrival point for many. The aid group Save the Children says refugee children risk hypothermia and pneumonia and other potentially fatal respiratory diseases. In Greece, the country's shipping minister is criticizing the action of the Coast Guard after arresting an alleged Turkish smuggler. The suspect was forced to look at the bodies of three dead migrant children who drowned while crossing the Aegean. The minister says officials should be cool-headed and professional with any detainee, no matter what the crime. Elsewhere, the UN Refugee Agency has an update on the situation in Yemen. It says despite ongoing conflict, well over 92,000 people arrived in Yemen by boat in 2015. It's one of the highest figures in the last 10 years. The UNHCR says nearly 90% of the arrivals last year in Yemen were from Ethiopia. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, and 18 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Cameroon Christians have started guarding mosques, and Muslims are guarding churches after attacks by suspected Boko Haram fighters. The UN Refugee Agency reports tens of thousands of newly displaced people in Niger are in desperate need of international assistance. And Shiite Muslims in Nigeria say they will not participate in a state inquiry into a deadly clash with the Nigerian military last month. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Children displaced by conflict in the Central African Republic are getting some help with their education. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, is assisting in the enrollment of children in primary schools. Anne Schaefer is a senior project coordinator for IOM in Bangui. She spoke with me about the enrollment of displaced children and the challenges they face.
In the past 2 years, a lot of schools have been hosting internally displaced people throughout the entirety of the Central African Republic. This has been a particular issue also here in Bangui, where several of the school buildings host IDPs until today. The education cluster under the UNICEF lead is in the process of trying to find solutions for those sites. There are a lot of IDP children who are usually supposed to be in school who still do not have access to adequate schooling systems, mainly because of the different waves of displacement which disrupted schooling, like the last wave of violence that we encountered here in September 2015, which closed schools for a quite extended period of 2 months, and schools are only very timidly reopening, and parents are very cautious about resending their children to school. There are several activities currently underway to increase reinscription in schools, to reopen schools, to encourage teachers to return to schools, and to encourage parents to send their children back to different education systems. We are seeing trends throughout the country where families are increasingly sending their children back to school. However, particularly for the IDP population, this is still very, very complicated.
Do you see the IDP population continuing to grow at this time?
For right now, the IDP population is stable. It's been stable since late November. Unfortunately, we do not see a very high trend of people returning from IDP sites to their communities of origin. This is mainly due to the ongoing elections. The first round of elections just took place in late 2015 on the 30th of December. And now we're waiting for the second round of elections, which is scheduled to take place in late January, early February. We're still waiting for the exact date to be published. And as long as the elections have not been finalized, IDPs are stating themselves that they will not be returning to their communities of origin. And this, of course, also impacts schools, because a lot of schools are being used as polling stations for the elections, and because a lot of the schools have been rehabilitated and offer an adequate surrounding for the election.
What are some of the other needs of the children at this time?
Well, in particular for IDP children, I think the situation in the Central African Republic in general, in Bangui, as the capital in particular, remains extremely dire. There is not a lot of funding in the Central African Republic to support IDP sites, so child-friendly spaces do exist in some of the larger sites, but not in all the sites. There is very limited support in terms of psychosocial assistance to displaced children. A lot of the families have been displaced several times, meaning they were displaced during the first wave of violence in 2013, potentially have returned to their communities of origin, were displaced a second time, potentially to a second site. So there is a lot of instability also within the family fabric and within the lives of the IDP children who have gone through different waves of violence and different waves of displacement. They lack basically everything that a child that would grow up in a more stable environment would have, and that starts from access to adequate shelter, to non-food items, to recreational activities, and to educational facilities. And not just formal education facilities, but also informal education facilities that could provide educational pastimes for children, and especially for youth.
Anne Schaefer is a senior project coordinator for the International Organization for Migration. She spoke with me from Bangui.
More than 7,000 babies are stillborn every day around the world. 75% of those deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa. A new report called The End of Preventable Stillbirth has been published in the medical journal The Lancet. It says progress has been too slow in reducing such deaths. VOA's David Arnold reports.
The world's highest rate of stillborn deaths occurs in Nigeria, where nearly 314,000 babies died before or at delivery last year. Dr. Hannah Blenko of the University of London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine took part in the research. She describes the challenges Nigerian health officials face in preventing newborn deaths.
Countries like Nigeria have high underlying rates of infections such as malaria and syphilis, which can all be important contributors to stillbirth but are easily treatable. And also, women aren't always able to access high-quality antenatal care to make sure they stay healthy during pregnancy. And if they have complications during delivery, and they're not always able to be accessing a high-quality, skilled birth attendant who has the ability to refer on in case complications occur.
More than half of stillbirths occur during labor or at birth. The report says more than 4 million women suffer years of depression as a result of losing their babies. Blenko saw firsthand the deep psychological impact that stillbirth has on mothers and entire families.
So I worked in Malawi for 5 years. Sadly, all too often have seen these issues and the different barriers and problems that have happened along the way that have led to a woman who wanted her baby and carry the baby for 9 months and going home empty-handed to her family. This has a tremendous psychological and heavy burden on women. I mean, I think probably the most harrowing one is women who have actually sought healthcare, but due to barriers of transport, not being able to detect the problem with the pregnancy and not being able to transfer to a place where women can have emergency care when she needed it, so not being able to access instrumental delivery, so delivery with a suction or with a section when a woman needs it, which would save both the woman's and the baby's life. The woman I'm thinking about, in the end, both herself and her baby died because the baby was stuck and the adequate treatment wasn't given in time. And this is utterly preventable. We can end preventable stillbirths.
Experts say most of the stillbirths, which occur in the last 3 months of a pregnancy, are preventable. The track record of many health ministries has been disappointing. However, Rwanda is ranked the most improved nation in reducing its number of stillbirths from around 9,800 15 years ago to about 5,900 today. Blanco says they did it by carefully studying what works.
So the example of Rwanda, it has the estimated highest rate of progress in sub-Saharan Africa, with stillbirths reducing it just under 3% per year. And if you look at Rwanda in the time period we're covering from 2000 to 2015, they've doubled the amount of women who are delivering in health facilities, so the women are able to coming in and receiving quality care. They've looked at the quality of care they give both antenatally and during the delivery, and actually without using high-tech or expensive interventions have improved the quality of care these women are getting. They've been looking and counting these mothers and these babies, looking at what went wrong and learning lessons and changing how they treat women, using national guidelines to ensure improved quality of care for all women. I think that's very powerful. So it's the combination of women being able to access the care and the care being of higher quality and a country being able to learn from what's not going right and with its own resource constraints, developing systems that will improve the health care receiving for women.
In order to significantly reduce stillbirths, Blanco says health ministries need to offer pregnant women better health care.
So we looked at what will happen going forward to stillbirth rates. And if we take the current progress, it would be 160 years before an average woman in sub-Saharan Africa has the same chance of her baby being born alive as a woman in the UK has today. That's a massively long time, so we need to be doing things different. But the different things that we can do don't need to be high-tech, they don't need to be very expensive, but they do need strong leadership, they need some investment, and they need us to be accountable to these women and their families and to these babies that are dying unnecessarily.
The report on the end of preventable stillbirth says there is funding for care of the babies after birth, but the authors recommend that much more be spent on health services for mother and child in the last 3 months before birth. David Arnold, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. Peace talks between the Burundian government and the opposition groups have been postponed, with no word on when they may resume. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss the crisis in Burundi. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Cameroon Christians have started guarding mosques, and Muslims are guarding churches after attacks by suspected Boko Haram fighters. Shiite Muslims in Nigeria say they will not participate in a state inquiry into a deadly clash between the group and the Nigerian military last month. And a new humanitarian response plan has been announced for Somalia. Coming up, music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, despite being termed a chronic but treatable disease, the fear of the HIV stigma still prevents many from exposing their status. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday, Kim.
And Sunny, I understand you are starting off with a Zambian football victory.
Kim, Zambia edge neighbor Zimbabwe Tuesday 1-0 at the African Nations Championship football tournament in Rwanda. Isaac Chanza, a 31-year-old midfielder, had the game's only goal about 60 minutes into the match at Umuganda Stadium in Gisenyi, located on Rwanda's border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. Chanza converted a free kick from Zambia's captain, Christopher Katongo. Chanza and Katongo were both members of the Zambian team that won the 2012 Africa Cup of Nations title in Libreville, Gabon. And remember, VOA football fans, while foreign-based players are allowed at the Africa Cup of Nations, this African Nations Championship, or CHAN, is exclusively for locally-based players in Africa. For a look back at Monday's CHAN action, we're joined once again on the Sunny Side of Sports by David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, let's give a Sunny Side of Sports shout-out for Chisholm Chikatara, a 21-year-old striker. He plays for Abia Warriors FC and a prolific scoring outburst in Rwanda. VOA! Tell our VOA football fans about that.
The interesting thing, Sunny, was he was not considered good enough to be in the starting lineup. He only came on as a substitute in the second half for Adeyemi. And lo and behold, he scored three, and he could have scored another two. He had several close shaves. This was Nigeria's first match. It was the start of Group C. They were playing Niger. And although normally you would say Nigeria would be expected to win comfortably, I'm sure in the back of those minds of the Nigerian footballers and also the coach, Sunday Olise, they would have recalled 2011 qualifying and the fact that Niger shocked Nigeria. They won 2-0 in Niamey, and then they drew 0-0 in Nigeria. So there undoubtedly would have been Nigerian respect for the underdogs. Not a great first half, Sunny. No goals. But it all changed just 25 seconds into the second half when Okoro gave Nigeria the lead. A deep cross, and he volleyed the ball beautifully from the far post across the goal and into the far corner of the net. So 1-0 to Nigeria. The Nigerians had a chance to equalize, but they messed up. And then it became the Chikatara show. It started in the 74th minute with his first goal. In the 80th minute, arguably the goal of the tournament so far came from Niger. And it was scored by Zakari Adebayor. And no relation whatsoever to the Togolese star, Emmanuel Adebayor. From the edge of the penalty area, magnificent, unstoppable rocket into the roof of the net. So it was game on at 2-1, but within 60 seconds, Chikatara had scored again, and suddenly it was game over. It was 3-1 to Nigeria. And to wrap up his personal triumph, he scored again 3 minutes into stoppage time to make it 4-1. And interestingly, Nigeria, for the third time, had scored four goals in a CHAN match, the only country to do this. Back in 2014, they beat Mozambique 4-2 in a group game. And then in a remarkable comeback, they wiped out a three-goal deficit in the quarterfinals to beat Morocco 4-3. and now they've beaten Niger 4-1. That was the second half, Sunny, of a doubleheader in Group C, and it was played at the Stade Kigali, which is the secondary stadium in the Rwandan capital. And the first match was a real thriller. Here, Tunisia were undoubtedly favourites pre-match against Guinea, and after 33 minutes, Akachi scored to put the North Africans in front. But on 40 minutes, Alseni Kamara Agogo, and the reason for that, Agogo at the end of his name, is in fact there are two Guineans in the squad with identical names. They're both called Alseni Kamara. So Agogo equalised. 6 minutes into the second half, Akachi put the Tunisians back in front, but the Guineans kept fighting away, and 7 minutes from time, Agogo struck again. So personal triumphs here for Akachi and Agogo, both scoring two goals each. I would have split the Man of the Match award, which incidentally in the Nigerian game, understandably, went to Chikatara. But in the other game, it went to Akachi, and I feel that the performance of Kamara was equally good. So why not bend the rules slightly, and instead of nominating one person, give it to both? Interesting statistics, Sonny, from this Guinea-Tunisia match. There were 42 fouls. Now, that's unacceptable. That's almost a foul every second minute. For the record, Tunisian committed 17 fouls and the Guineans 25. Also interesting was the number of offsides. Tunisia 8 and Guinea 4. And also an awful lot of corners, 7 for the Tunisians and 8 for the Guineans. But a really good match this, arguably the best match so far in the tournament. Group C, Nigeria out in front with 3 points and a very healthy +3 goal difference. Guinea and Tunisia have got 1 point each, and Niger at the bottom, no points.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg. David also confirms the hat trick scored on Monday by Nigeria's Chisom Chikatara was the second in Chan history. David says the Zambian Given Singaluma scored 3 goals in the maiden edition of the African Nations Championship in 2009 when Zambia beat host Ivory Coast 3-0 in the opening match in Abidjan.
It's another tequila sunrise, staring slowly across the sky. Said goodbye.
The Sunny Side of Sports says goodbye to Glenn Frey, the co-founder of the high-flying, legendary American band, the Eagles. Frey died on Monday at age 67. Thanks for all the great music, Glenn. Turning to African golf, for the second week in a row, a young South African has won a big international tournament on home soil. 21-year-old Hayden Porteous shot a 3-under par 69 Sunday to win the Joburg Open by 2 strokes for his first European Tour title. Porteous finished at 18-under par 269 at Royal Johannesburg and Kensington Golf Club in Johannesburg. Reporter Mark Tompkins caught up with Hayden Porteous after his victory. Here's Mark.
Hayden, many congratulations. You're the Joburg Open champion. How does that feel?
It feels surreal right now. You know, I don't think it hasn't set in just yet. You know, I think when I get home and things start to calm down, I'm going to have a proper think about it. And you know, and all the doors that are open because of winning the Joburg Open, you know, it's a dream come true.
And as you say, it opens up doors to playing events you could probably only dream about, you know, just last year, maybe the year before.
Yeah, I mean, to qualify to get into the Open, you know, on merit is, you know, a big step in my career. And, you know, to play the Open for any player in the world is a big deal. And, you know, hopefully I can do South Africa proud and do well there.
You pushed your tee shot on the first today. Were there a few nerves out there when you stood there at 20 past 12?
Well, I pulled it. But it wasn't in a great position, but you know, there was obviously a few nerves on the tee shot, and you know, luckily I started to hit a few more fairways and a few more greens and gave myself some chances at making birdie. Unfortunately the putts didn't drop, but you know, that's golf. And, you know, I just kept the pressure, you know, as low as I could possibly keep it. You know, to make the birdie on the 18th was, you know, the best feeling in the world.
I was about to say, it was a great reaction when your second hit the green. That must have been, I mean, what was going through your mind at that point when you got a two-shot advantage?
Yeah, I'm just thinking, you know, no silly mistakes, you know, just go left side of the green and hope that the wind drags it to the right. You know, and I just hit probably the best 5-iron I've hit all week, and it landed, you know, maybe just short of pin high and rolled to about 15, 20 foot, and, you know, a putt that I could only dream of to win the Joburg Open.
That's 21-year-old Hayden Porteous, the winner of the 2016 Joburg Open Golf Tournament. And Hayden was talking with reporter Mark Tompkins in Johannesburg, South Africa.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
In pro basketball, the defending champion Golden State Warriors crushed the host Cleveland Cavaliers 132-98 on Monday night. The Warriors embarrassed the Cavaliers, easily winning on the same court where they won the NBA championship last June. That was Golden State's first NBA title in 40 years, and the Warriors certainly look ready to defend their championship right now. Sharpshooting guard Stephen Curry made 7 three-point shots for the Warriors against the Cavs. Curry ended up with 35 points. In other NBA results, the Charlotte Hornets beat the Utah Jazz 124-119 in double overtime. Kemba Walker scored a club record 52 points for host Charlotte. Yes, VOA basketball fans, Charlotte is the club owned by retired basketball great Michael Jordan. In another double overtime game, the New York Knicks defeated the Philadelphia 76ers 119-113. Aaron Aflalo led the Knicks with 25 points, and Carmelo Anthony had 19 points. Finally, in African athletics, the 2016 London Marathon on April 24th is shaping up as another great Kenyan duel. London organizers announced on Tuesday that 2015 champion Eliud Kipchoge will take on the 2014 champion Wilson Kipsang. The two Kenyans head a stellar field once again in the British capital. Last year, Kipchoge beat Kipsang, a two-time London champion, by just 5 seconds in a thrilling sprint finish. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, trying to change unhealthy eating habits in Nigeria. And next, despite being termed a chronic but treatable disease, the fear of the HIV stigma still prevents many from exposing their status. But for some music, here is Rocky Dawuni of Ghana with The Master Plan.
Trouble, oh. And in in hand we carry each other. Come on people, lift up your heart. Now that you have seen the light, we must sing this song with one great voice. Surviving the master plan. Surviving, surviving now. Ghana people, make you take you go higher. Come Africa, make you light my fire. And I'll be proud. I could not believe the news today. Another hero falls in South Africa. White beauty.
Rocky Dawuni of Ghana with the master plan.
While innovations continue to change our world, from technology to farming techniques to the way foods are packaged, in Nigeria, Afiong Williams is hoping to change unhealthy eating habits through her company, Real Fruits. As VOA's Esther Katui reports, the young entrepreneur has set her eyes and her business on healthy, vitamin-rich snacks.
To eat fresh or try dried fruits. Well, that is now a personal choice in our world today. Using personal savings and loans from family and friends, 29-year-old Afiong Williams returned home to Nigeria to set up a beverage and snack company after working for a small business in South Africa. She started out at her home and eventually moved her factory to Lagos. Her company, Real Fruits, processes and packages dried fruits for sale to Nigerians who want to have healthy snacks. Launched in 2012 with an initial investment of $100,000, Afiong now employs 17 people. She says she saw a gap in the market and capitalized on the opportunity.
Well, I was actually attracted to the sector for a number of reasons. Firstly, there's untapped opportunity in processing and value addition of raw materials. And I also believe that, it's a very budding sector. There's a lot of opportunity, as well as the job creation, which I think is quite important to me as an entrepreneur, to be able to, play in an industry that would create a lot of jobs.
The fruits are dried in Ogun State, then packaged by Real Fruits in Lagos for distribution across the country. Afiong says at first, learning curve to start a business was quite challenging.
It was not easy introducing something new into the market, such as dried fruits. The market has taken a while to accept it, but I think, we're getting to the stage where, people like the products and, want more of them and are buying more of it. And so that has just necessitated our growth. We do have big ambitions to scale into a world-class factory that allows us to also export some of our dried fruit. So that's our next, big goal as a company.
Real Fruits distributes 5 products: coconut, banana, mango, cashew, and pineapple. The prices range from 150 to 400 naira, the equivalent of 75 cents to $2. Afiong says for Nigeria's agribusiness to thrive, the country needs to address structural issues affecting the agricultural sector.
I think agriculture, the sector primarily, is obviously more complicated than people expect. People anticipate. I think there's so many issues with the sort of structural issues with the sector. So for any sort of, I think, success, it would take a lot of planning and understanding, and also a lot of technical understanding, which I think is one of the big missing pieces, even from farming all the way to processing.
With crude oil prices at an all-time low and at a time when Nigeria's government is encouraging investment in agriculture to reduce its over-reliance on oil exports, Afiong is working hard to make her business a key player in the agribusiness. Esther Gidui Ewart, VOA News, Washington.
A HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, is no longer the life-threatening medical condition it was when it was first discovered more than 30 years ago. However, despite it now being termed a chronic but treatable disease, fear of stigma still prevents many from exposing their status or going for testing. Health experts warn that stigma could defeat efforts to end the spread of the disease. Ilofi Sibanda is an HIV/AIDS consultant with the Southern African Development Community, or SADC. She tells Gibbs Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service that while stigma is declining, more awareness is needed, especially from leaders in the community and other influential areas.
Stigma came at a time when HIV was not treatable, where it was very difficult to manage it and where people were associating HIV infection with almost the loss of life. I think we've made a lot of gains in that now HIV is now really treated as a chronic disease, which will last for many, many years. So the question of how to deal with the stigma is really to increase the gospel, if you like, of how well we are now able to manage this condition. So that is no longer a thing to be hidden under the shelf. And it will take time because we have generations that were exposed to the older phase of HIV and to the newer generations, we just have to get the good news to spread.
We still remember that some parliamentarians at one stage actually went out to show that they were HIV negative and so forth, you know, after getting tested. But some people still believe that when you're HIV positive, you've got a problem. Maybe you are promiscuous or something like that. What do you think about that?
I think the example by parliamentarians was actually excellent. And they were trying to face up with the fact that stigma is one of the causes of the increasing rate of HIV. Where there's stigma, people get more and more infected and they don't seek treatment. So the example of parliamentarians was good. But what needs to be done is not a one-off, but a continuous process which is led by the lead community leaders like parliamentarians, but as well as by church leaders, if the church leaders can also give a word and help to spread the good word that this is a condition that is manageable and that we as Zimbabwe now are quite cautiously optimistic that by 2030 we might reach a goal of no more new cases. So there's a lot of good news to be said, and I think that has to be spread better, and we have to organize ourselves in a better way to communicate the fact that we can control this condition, and if it's picked up early, the control is better.
What will happen if, let's say, prominent people like soccer players actually come out and tell the public about their status? Will that change maybe for the better?
It should. It should be able to change for the better, but it's a process. It's a mental process where people who are HIV positive will be able to tell everybody else. And they may, as individuals, want to discuss that, but maybe they have to consult the families and so on. It takes a long process sometimes. But if that can be achieved by prominent people, politicians included, business people, all those people that are thought to be community leaders and role models, then that should be very beneficial to stopping the issue of stigma.
Now, Professor Spanda, why do you think that people with HIV are still shunned in Zimbabwe?
I actually do not think they are shunned. I think that there is a perception which is born out of the stigma that if I tell people, they will think about me as something, or as somebody who is, as you are putting it, who has been behaving in a way which are less acceptable than others. So generally, we still have some way to go, but there's a lot of improvement in the understanding of the condition, and in particular in the understanding that this is a lifelong condition that can be controlled very effectively. It doesn't affect their work, their career choices. It doesn't even affect whether they will or will not have babies. I think within 5 or so years, everybody should be able to be talking about it without any problem.
Any justification for that?
I think it's because we are more and more aware. We have a major campaign by the WHO, the 1990 campaign. We'll be testing and treating people as soon as they are diagnosed. And that way, we will reach out many more people. And then that awareness becomes shared by the community. And we should be able to minimize the stigma within that time frame based on the interventions that the WHO is promoting and that the government of Zimbabwe has embraced.
Elfosi Banda is an HIV/AIDS consultant with the Southern African Development Community. He spoke with Gibbs Dube from Harare. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Local communities are the key to turning the tide against terrorism. Whether in France, Turkey, or the United States, said Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell, militaries and intelligence agencies can protect us from external threats and bring terrorists to justice. But they cannot address the complex motives and hateful ideologies that drive people to terrorism in the first place. Real progress against terrorism requires not only eliminating terrorists, but also disrupting the process by which people become terrorists. Only a broader and more holistic approach can ensure that new recruits don't join the ISIL battlefield. The United States has promoted this broader approach to tackling terrorism at home and abroad under the mantle of Countering Violent Extremism, or CVE, which recognizes that empowered communities are among the best antidotes for preventing the spread of terrorist ideologies. The first step to implementing a holistic approach is to ensure that public officials at home and abroad uphold the rule of law and respect for human rights. When governments fail to protect, respect, and serve all their people, it creates openings that terrorists eagerly exploit. According to the Global Terrorism Index, 92% of all terrorist attacks over the last 25 years occurred in countries where state-sponsored violence, such as torture and political imprisonment, was widespread. Second, said Ambassador Sewell, public officials must build trust with local leaders and communities. From Afghanistan to Somalia to Colombia, research shows that when populations are marginalized and supporting institutions are absent, communities become more vulnerable to violent extremism. But when locals know what to look for and whom to call to protect friends and family from radical ideologies, and when they trust authorities to help them, those ideologies struggle to take root. As the terrorist threat posed by the Islamic State continues to grow, partnerships with Muslim communities at home and abroad are more critical than ever. As President Barack Obama has said, ISIL does not speak for Islam, and Muslims around the world are our greatest allies in debunking perversions of their faith. In the long run, the way to defeat groups like ISIL is to promote democratic values and strong communities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. Peace talks between the Burundian government and the opposition groups have been postponed, with no word on when they may resume. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss the crisis in Burundi. That's next time on VOA Africa.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.